cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is here, as always. How are you, Witt?
Yeah, I'm good, and yourself?
No, excellent. I think the last week's podcast is going to be one of our biggest ones yet.
Yeah, it's doing well.
Professor Peterson. So, yeah, if you have heard it, let us know what you think.
Yeah, it's really a great podcast, some great listening, and some mind-blowing sort of concepts.
Well, yeah, I heard it about 5 times now.
Yeah, so you've got some catching up to do, because by the time you hear this, Ramon's probably heard it about 10 times.
No. I've had my fill.
We do literally like the sound of our own voices.
Well, especially mine. I find it very sexy.
How's the YFM gig?
Oh, well, so far so good. I mean, I'm just there for the week as a testing out phase. It's like BE in reverse. They needed a white guy with controversial opinions. I'm like, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if by the time you hear this, if he'll still be on. He may come back if he's not, but Ramon has been recording on YFM every morning, so you're welcome to give him a listen. It is music radio, so they don't give you that much time to talk.
No, it is music radio, but we do go through news, and I do speak a fair bit, but it's really not a podcast thing. It's a completely different way of broadcasting.
Cool. And you will have heard quite a few international guests now in a row today, that's included. If you do want to hear anyone specific, please let us know. And we're working on a number of high-profile guests, as always. Anything on the current sort of events that you want to chat about quickly?
No, not really. Okay, well, we're recording this a bit early, but I mean, in Rosettenville, there's the brothel's being burnt down by the community, and the libertarian mayor says...
But where will they get sex now?
Not from their wives. But the libertarian mayor is like now going in and raiding, and I don't know, it just feels a bit un-libertarian to me.
Said libertarian, we are trying to get on the show, but...
difficult man.
His people have abandoned email. Apparently it's not a very libertarian principle either. Anyway, we're giving Mr. Mashaba a bit of a hard time, but we would like him on the show to discuss all of these things and the complexities, I suppose, of running a government or a local government and trying to keep things as free as possible. But should we get on to today's guest?
Absolutely. So today's one of my personal, not heroes, I hate the term heroes, my personal favorite writer. I've been reading him for like a decade.
Yeah.
And yeah, we finally got him on. So, yeah. His name is Brendan O'Neill. He's the editor of SpikedOnline.com, which is an online magazine, like Daily Maverick, but much, much better. And he's an odd character because he's a Marxist, but he believes in like utter liberty at the same time. So we're going to discuss those weird contradictions.
And our guest this week is Brendan O'Neill. Thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Yeah.
Well, Brendan, I mean, so good to have you on. I've been reading you for, I think, a decade now, if not more.
Wow.
However long Spiked Online's been around, I've been there. Your one South African reader is right here in front of your eyes. So, Brendan, interesting thing about you. You used to write for a magazine called Living Marxism. I think it was called Living Marxism. So, and you do call yourself a Marxist sometimes. However, you hate the state, which is Marxist, but you also love liberty and freedom, especially in terms of speech. So how do you reconcile those two positions?
Well, I don't think they are necessarily contradictory. And when I refer to myself as a Marxist, I'm always talking about early Marxism. I mean, right back to Marx himself and Engels, those people who were thinking and writing in the 1840s and the 1850s. And if you read their original stuff, it was almost entirely devoted to the idea of freedom. I mean, for example, in the 1840s, when Karl Marx was very, very young, he wrote a series of essays and articles about press freedom. And I guarantee you, you will not read a finer, more liberal defense of press freedom than what Karl Marx wrote back then. And if you read the work of Marx and Engels and other writers of the time, it was very much about how can we expand human choice and human freedom and allow people to have more pleasurable lives. That's what it was boiled down to. But of course, since then, not long after then, in fact, the left did completely lose the plot. That was particularly true in the 20th century. The left, bit by bit, moved away from trusting ordinary people to be able to run their lives and maybe even to run society, towards trusting the state more than people and asking the state to govern not simply society itself in detail, but also people's lives, how they speak, how they behave, how they relate to one another. So I think the left has lost it, but I would always challenge the idea that being pro-state is an original left-wing idea. I think in its origins, the left-wing was quite naturally anti-state.
So you're like a hipster Marxist in a way.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, people when they talk about pop bands and they say, oh, I liked them before they were popular. I'm like that with Marxism. I like the early stuff before everyone else got into it. That's the kind of stuff I'm into.
Before communism destroyed it, basically.
Yes, before socialism with a capital S, my least favorite ideology, before all that stuff came along, and particularly state socialism, which is just a complete drag on human autonomy and freedom and everything else. So before all that, I think the idea of the left at the very beginning, I mean, if you go right back to the French Revolution, which is, of course, where the idea of the left comes from, the people who sat on the left side of the revolutionary French assembly, if you go right back to that in the late 1700s through to the mid 1800s, that period of around 50 or 60 years, the left in that period was pro-reason, pro-freedom, trusted people, had an instinctive distrust of officialdom and churches and anyone else who wanted to tell people how to behave. That, I think, was a political high point for humankind, but it did go downhill. So I perfectly understand when people look at me now and say, you call yourself left-wing, that means you're pro-state and you're anti-people and you don't like free speech, because tragically, that's what it means now to be left-wing.
Is it just that essentially the those in power always act in the same kind of way? Because if you're referring all the way back to the French Revolution, that was the kind of peasants rising up against the elite, more on the so-called left. And now we really have a society or a world, especially in the West, where you could argue that the left has been in control and in power for many decades now. And essentially they've become the elite. And whether you're left or right, you can't help but become this almost destructive force against individuals.
I think there's a lot in that, actually. I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, one of the things I'm intrigued by, and I don't have an answer to this, is the question of why revolutions tend to go wrong and tend to lead to bad things. I mean, this goes right back to the English Civil War in the 1640s, which is one of my favorite moments in history, when basically you had a bunch of parliamentarians fighting against a bunch of monarchists to institute the modern idea of democracy, in essence. And there were groups within the parliamentarian side in the Civil War, which we would these days refer to as libertarians. There were groups who they were publishing pamphlets on press freedom, and they were handing them out on street corners and in their local pub, saying we demand freedom of speech, we demand the right to publish whatever we want, we demand, let's cut the king's head off. And then there was this moment of beautiful radicalism in the 1640s in England. And of course, they succeed. And what happens? It gives rise to Cromwellism and rule by Cromwell in a quite dictatorial fashion. And that was a very early example of how, for some reason that people haven't quite sufficiently explained, revolutionary moments, even very positive ones, quite quickly give way to tyranny or authoritarianism or something that's not particularly pleasant. And we see that from the English Civil War to the French Revolution, obviously to the Russian Revolution, which was the biggest downturn of all time in terms of what happened after the Russian Revolution. In all those instances, it happens. So I think there's something about humankind not quite being able to see through on its rather lofty ambitions to make people freer and happier, something goes horribly wrong. And I think it could well be related to the fact that once you're in power and once you have the responsibility to keep the machine of government or the machine of state chugging along, then perhaps you do develop instinctively authoritarian tendencies. So that is the ultimate question of our time, I think.
So, Brendan, are you largely in favor of having a state, or would you consider yourself an anarchist?
I'm not an anarchist, and I do think there are some things the state probably should do. I mean, I make myself incredibly unpopular among my free market friends by suggesting that I think there are some things the state should do with the economy. I don't think it should control the economy. I'm opposed to the cult of welfarism, and I don't think nationalizing industry is a particularly good idea, especially now when the state is such a kind of lethargic, a backward institution that, you know, couldn't organize a piss up in a brewery, never mind a national rail system
or an operation in a hospital or anything.
You wouldn't really trust it to do anything serious like that. But I'm not opposed to the state kickstarting investment, for example. I'm not opposed to the state saying we are going to build 10 nuclear power stations in the next 20 years and we invite you big businesses to come and invest and help and create work and so on. I'm not opposed to the state playing that kind of role. The problem is today that the state does not enough of what I think it should be doing and far too much of what I think it shouldn't be doing. So it doesn't do enough of saying, you know, screw it, let's build 15 new airports and 15 new nuclear power stations and create 300,000 jobs. It doesn't do enough of that, but it does far too much of coming up with new forms of censorship, new forms of social control, CCTV cameras, interfering in family life and giving everyone lessons on how to raise your children, interfering in education to tell people what they should be learning so they come out the other end as very conformist, unthinking slaves to modern capitalism and everything else. So it does way too much of that interfering in personal life and speech and freedom of thought and so on, and not enough of the slightly bigger R&D ideas that it might be worth it trying out. That's my problem with the state at the moment.
That sounds a lot like Trump's economic plan, to be honest.
Well, I hope not. I'm not a fan of Trump at all. I don't buy Trump's economic ideas. I'm not convinced that he's going to see them through in any convincing way. I'm fairly happy about the fact that he does talk about such economic matters. I think one of the key problems with the left today is that it's largely abandoned the question of economic equality or even wealth creation and job creation and all those things which really animated the left for decades and decades. The modern left has completely abandoned economic questions in favor of questions of identity and protecting the environment and making sure that people are happy and all those other various kind of very tangential ideas. That was really shown up. There's this thing in Britain called the British Surveys Attitude, which comes out every couple of years, which basically is this huge, vast, very interesting survey of what people in Britain think. And the latest one was published last week, and it showed that among young people under the age of 25, they are extremely pro-diversity. So they are utterly relaxed about your religion and your skin color and your sexuality, and they don't think anyone should be judged for anything like that. They think diversity is wonderful, and in fact, they go too far and end up celebrating divisions within society and so on. But then it also discovered that they are not concerned at all about economic inequality or even very much about poverty. And I think that's really was a really interesting snapshot of how leftish, youthful, millennial thought has shifted away from the question that animated the right and the left for 200 years, in essence, which is how can we create more things and produce more stuff, towards the question of managing relations between different groups in society, managing how we interact, managing how we speak to each other. I think that shift on the left is a real concern.
Isn't that a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, though, because what the left has done is, in their pursuit of diversity, they have really gone around the world looking for as many different people as they could possibly find. You know, they would claim they aren't racist or they aren't bigoted in any way, but they will do their best to, for example, in the UK, they will very much focus on how many white people they are and then try bringing in every color in between to prove how not racist they are. And so they've been so focused on diversity that you get this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy of what you're kind of talking about with regards to them not fulfilling, achieving these kinds of goals, and with regards to people being very focused on diversity, but not on any of the other stuff.
Yes, I think there's a real problem with the focus on diversity at the moment, because what's happening is that diversity has been institutionalized as a value within it in its own right. So the great thing about modern Britain or about modern America or, in fact, about modern South Africa, most strikingly in many ways, is simply the fact that it's diverse, not the fact that it has overarching values, not the fact that there is a core idea of what the nation is and what its values are that people might subscribe to or be invited to subscribe to. Instead, we celebrate diversity for its own sake, and that has an extremely divisive dynamic. And I think one of the things I've been arguing is that the left and other sections of society are really re-racializing society. They are re-racializing everyday life. And you can really see this on campuses in particular, which are often the kind of laboratory for ideas that will eventually become much more mainstream, where people are now divided according to their race. And people are referred to very casually as white man. You know, you can't say this because you're a white man. You shouldn't say that because you're a white woman. Black people have a special understanding of certain situations that other people don't. There's this real instinct continually to box people off according to their race or their gender or their sex or some other biological accident over which people have no control. And I find that incredibly depressing because, you know, one of the key arguments of progressive politics for a long period of time was that there's something higher than your skin color and your sex and your sexuality. There is something which is above that. There's an idea of a human family. Universal values.
That's how we got over racism was by saying you can't judge someone based on their skin color because they're a human and they're just like you with their own thoughts and ideas.
Exactly.
And now we sort of flipped over if you're on the progressive side of things.
Exactly. And that's really, really dangerous, I think. And in fact, we've now reached the perverse situation where if you are anti-racist, you will be accused of being racist. So, for example, there are some campuses in America now where they have these guidelines against using racial microaggressions. And a microaggression, as you all know, is an accidental turn of phrase or something you say in a conversation which is kind of can be interpreted as aggressive or prejudicial. And some campuses have guidelines about what kind of racial microaggressions you should avoid, and they include things like I don't see race, I only see the human race, and they even include things like I judge people according to what they say and think rather than according to their race. Now, of course, if that sounds familiar, that's because it was the rallying cry of the civil rights movement in America in the 1950s and 60s, the idea that you should judge someone. Yeah, Martin Luther King, judge someone by their character, not the content of their character, not the color of their skin. Now, on some campuses in America, if you do that, if you do what Martin Luther King suggested we should do, you will be hauled up for committing a racial microaggression because, in the words of these documents, you are denying people's racial experiences. Now, as far as I'm concerned, progressive politics used to be entirely about denying people's racial experiences and refusing to treat people as racial categories. So there's all this concern about raising racial awareness. And my argument to that is, well, I refuse to be racially aware. And I think people should refuse to be racially aware.
Well, in South Africa, there's a well-known intellectual that says, if you are colorblind or you don't see color, that is actually the reason why you have white privilege. Because you're so privileged that you can't see how important race is, despite making a conscientious effort to not see race.
Is that the same intellectual that uses the year as an argument?
Oh, yes. It's 2017 is his favorite argument as well. But it's remarkable. It's a self-perpetuating feedback loop.
Yes, it's crazy, really. And I think that whole discussion of white privilege is really important and interesting, because that demonstrates the extent to which the left and modern liberals have completely abandoned the language of class and the idea that your social station is the deciding factor. So when I hear people talk about white male privilege, I always think, well, what white men are you talking about? Are you talking about the white man who fixed your toilet Absolutely. In the morning and then drove you in a car to the radio station so you could go on the radio and moan about white men? I mean, what white men are they talking about? They have no understanding of class differences. So white men get painted as this huge, vast category, all of them enjoying privilege, even though it includes people who are absolutely broke and are not sure how they're going to feed themselves in the next week. And it includes billionaires. So there's that, when you have this kind of broad stroke, this racial broad stroke, where everyone gets painted as belonging to one racial group by accident of their birth, then it really undermines social differences and class differences, which I think are still very important. In fact, I would argue that class differences, even though I think class politics is dead and probably isn't coming back in that old form anytime soon, class differences are, I think, still the most decisive differences of all.
Well, very much so. That's what we've been arguing on this podcast for a long time. If you look at the stats for South Africa, there's 10 million people who are deemed to be living in poverty. And then the rest are middle class and upper class. So the middle class and the upper class, there's more black people in them than white people. But pro rata, there's far more poor people at the bottom than more black poor people than white people. So people use that. Instead of saying, let's just look at the poor people, they say the poor black people are what's important, not all the people in that class. And I think class is the biggest problem we have in South Africa. But people keep on trying to racialize it, especially the government in charge.
Yes, and there's a similar, I mean, it's a very different historical experience, but there's a similar dynamic in Britain at the moment where everyone wants to talk about the problem of whiteness, and everyone focuses on how we can help ethnic minority groups, particularly ethnic minority girls, to get to university and to be more successful and so on. But if you look at the actual statistics, the people who are least likely to go to university in Britain are working class white males. And they are at the bottom of the heap educationally. They are far less likely to go to university than black girls or Chinese girls or even than black boys, which is a very new development, because black boys used to be the bottom of the pile in the past. So even though all these dramatic shifts have taken place and the white working classes are very notably being left behind from the knowledge economy and from the new economy that supposedly has risen up in Britain over the past few years, even though that's happening, people still obsess over affirmative action for certain minority groups and boosting the self-esteem of young girls and so on. And what happens as a consequence of that is that a certain class in society, which happens to be white-skinned, because a lot of the native working classes in Britain are white-skinned, are just utterly left behind. So there's a very cavalier, almost cruel consequence of the focus on identity politics, which is that the vast swathes of society simply are not helped out because they don't fit the right identity criteria.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of what's happened as a result of a focus on that identity criteria. Let's start with Brexit, because we, before Brexit, correctly predicted it, we like to say. We had a good year in 2016. I know the rest of the world had a terrible year, but we had a good year. So Brexit happened. The world lost their minds. It was the first sort of preamble to how you lose your mind as a journalist. I think your colleagues in all the mainstream papers sort of just lost it. There was everything from the economy is going to completely collapse to Britain won't be able to trade with anyone, to we will be excluded from the entire European market, to you won't be able to travel, you won't be able to get kids across borders, all kinds of scaremongering. How much do you think a role the scaremongering before the Brexit sort of happens or influenced it? And also, you know, afterwards, we've seen that most of that's been untrue. So where do you, I know you were pro Brexit, but what's your views on the entire process up until now?
Well, Brexit, in my view, is the best thing to happen, not only in British politics, but in Western politics for the past 25 years. I mean, yeah. Brexit is the only thing in my lifetime that I would go to the barricades for. I would make Molotov cocktails to defend Brexit. I feel so deeply passionate about Brexit. And the reason is because it's so obvious to me, it's so clear to me and to many other people, many of the other 17 million who voted for it, that it was a democratic revolt. And it was an extremely rebellious act, because we have to remember back, you just talked there about how about the politics of fear that was used to try and convince people to vote in favor of the European Union. And so you had this intense politics of fear, this economic blackmail, these warnings of doom. 80% of the political class were pro-EU and told us we had to vote to stay. The whole celebrity set did the same thing. 95% of top business leaders told us we should vote to stay in the EU. Every global institution on earth said the same thing. Obama, the UN, every single influential body and group, and of course all experts, said you must stay in the EU or else your lives will be ruined.
Yeah, well, Obama threatened you, in fact, and actually tried to influence your elections, you know, as other people get upset about American elections being influenced.
Exactly. He said that we would go to the back of the queue in terms of trade if we didn't stay in the EU. And in the face of all that, 17.4 million people, including vast numbers of working class people in former industrial towns in the north of England and in Wales, people who hadn't voted for a long time, they went out. They thought for themselves. They discussed it among themselves. There are these fabulous polls that came out just before the referendum, asking people who were intending to vote leave, who do you trust most on this issue? And the media and politicians came at the very bottom. And at the top, there were things like my family, my workmates, and even on one of the polls, it said strangers in the street. So you had this real democracy in action. People were talking about it at work, at home, on the bus, with strangers, and they came to the decision rationally and calmly that it would be beneficial to democracy and to the idea of popular sovereignty if we voted against the EU and voted to leave the EU. So they defied establishment diktat. They defied the warnings from on high, and they took a very democratic course of action. And what's great is that I think that's inspired people around the world. Everywhere I go now, America, Australia, Europe, everyone wants to ask me about Brexit. People are excited about Brexit. They feel moved by Brexit. I think Brexit is the most positive idea in the world at the moment. I think it's been slightly misused by Trump, and it's been profoundly misused by Marine Le Pen in France, both of whom are trying to use the moral authority of Brexit to make themselves seem more progressive than they maybe are. But I think Brexit was a great break from the old politics of technocracy, and it raised all these unanswered questions about sovereignty and democracy and class and so on. So I think it's been absolutely wonderful, and I will not hear a bad word said against Brexit.
I mean, we tend to agree with you. We were both big Brexit supporters way before. When the referendum was announced, we said, no, Brexit must happen for various reasons, all of which you just mentioned. But do you think it will actually happen? Because Theresa May has come in after the fact, and she seems to say, you know, Brexit is Brexit, and there's no soft Brexit or whatever the case might be. It's a hard Brexit. But a lot of attempts have been made to thwart triggering of Article 50, which is the process to exit the EU. So will it actually happen, or will it happen but in a way that is not hard Brexit, for the lack of a better word?
Yeah, well, that's the big question. I mean, there is at the moment, and I'm always amazed that people aren't on the streets over this, but at the moment there is an elitist revolt against Brexit, an elitist revolt against democracy itself, against the people. So we have these extremely wealthy, influential people taking court cases to prevent the triggering of Article 50, forcing Brexit back into Parliament so that MPs can vote on it, even though they've already voted on it on the 23rd of June, like the rest of us. Apparently, they need to have a second vote to before it can go through. There have been huge mass protests in the streets largely by the pissed off middle classes, demanding that Brexit be halted, demanding that it be stopped, insisting that ordinary people didn't understand the question, and so on. So there is this elitist revolt against Brexit, which I find incredibly anti-democratic. And in fact, it's rehabilitating all the old, ugly arguments against democracy. The idea that we are low information, which is another way of saying we're stupid. The idea that ordinary people are beholden to demagogues and cannot resist the charms of demagogues. The idea that the education system isn't good enough to equip people with the politics they need to make big decisions like this. I mean, constant rehashing of all the arguments against democracy that have existed for the past 200 or 300 years. So we're witnessing a pretty vile turn against democracy. And as you say, as a consequence of that, it is not certain that Brexit will happen. And I do worry about that a lot. And I think we need to be extremely vigilant extremely insistent that the people's will is acted upon. What will happen over the next few weeks will be very decisive, because Brexit is now back in Parliament. Theresa May is pretty insistent that it will happen, but there are lots of MPs who are trying to temper it and tame it and water it down. So I think we've got to keep an eye on how that goes.
I just wonder if they sort of stop it from happening in any real sense, how much that will kill democracy and what that might do. You know, I don't think people will necessarily take up arms, but we've already seen that the Labour Party is probably dead in the UK. I don't think they will ever run their own government again, not in the foreseeable future, at least, especially with Corbyn around. I'm just interested to know what you think in terms of what it might do to people and their faith in the system if this is ignored.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people here are talking about the English Civil War, which is where modern England was born. This, as I was saying earlier, the 1640s Civil War. And a lot of people are talking about that. And some people are saying there's a whiff of Civil War in the air, because Britain is now pretty clearly divided between Remainers, who and most influential people are Remainers, and Leavers, which includes vast numbers of ordinary people who normally don't engage with politics, but from now on they will be. So there is a divide. It is reminiscent of divides in the past that turned violent. So I don't think there's going to be a new civil war, but I do think that there is a tension under all this. There is a conflict. It's just not been honestly expressed. And I'm very interested in that. And I think the consequences, if Brexit was not pushed through, the consequences for democracy would be completely disastrous. And not only in Britain. I think it would have repercussions across Europe. Because what it would say is that ordinary people cannot be trusted to make these decisions, and therefore maybe democracy is not such a good idea. And the reason the elites in Europe, across Europe, are so terrified of Brexit is because it did this wonderful thing. It really ripped away the insulation that the political class has put around it over the past few decades in order to protect it from popular opinion. You know, really, since the Second World War in particular, almost every political initiative from governments in Europe has been to insulate themselves from popular opinion, whether it was through developing the idea of expertise and that certain decisions should be made by experts, the rise of quangos, the rise of the judiciary and its intervention in political questions, and of course the rise of the EU, which was the clearest bureaucratic expression of this insulation of the political class from the plebs. And what Brexit has done is that it starts to chip away at that insulation. It starts to rip away all these various filtering mechanisms, which meant that ordinary people's opinion, popular opinion, often didn't reach the political class and didn't influence politics. So Brexit is a wonderful step forward for democracy and a wonderful step backward for all these undemocratic technocrats who had shaped a whole new kind of politics in the post-war period. That's why they're terrified of it, and that's why it's so important that we defend it and ensure that it does actually happen.
I mean, I like that term you use about the insulation of the political class. However, I think the biggest culprit has been the media in all of this. I mean, you're quite a fierce critic of Obama, but the media loved him. I mean, the media didn't have any way of ensuring that he received bad news somehow or other. I mean, Trump's been in power for 3 weeks. They're already making porn movies about him, right? Imagine having a porn movie of Obama. You'll be called all sorts of things. So, but the media as well, it has insulated the political class from what people are actually thinking. And then that's when you get Brexit and Donald Trump being voted in. So as a journalist yourself, Brendan, I mean, do you see yourself... You're independent, of course, but is the media space extremely tenuous at the moment?
Yeah, I have a big problem with the media at the moment, with the modern media and with the role that it plays. And I think the media has become a wing of the establishment in many ways, and it is losing its independence. And I find the coverage of Trump just utterly, utterly mind-blowing and extraordinary. I can't remember anything as hysterical as this in recent years. The way in which the majority of the Western media, I think 91% of media coverage of Trump is negative, which is extraordinary. And the language they use, they talk about, you know, they're continually dredging up the 1930s and using words like fascism and making these kind of sly references to the Holocaust, as if Europe and America and the rest of the world is being plunged back 80 years to, you know, to the darkest moment in human history. Just these wild exaggerations, completely over the top. No sense of rationalism or objectivity or measuring things and thinking calmly about things. And that's because the media had been so wedded in many ways to the old establishment and to the old technocratic elites, which had governed things pretty much with free rein for 30 or 40 years. They were so intimately linked with those elites and so favorable of them that they've lost the plot. Now that those old establishments find themselves on the back foot and find that huge numbers of the population reject their ideas and reject the way they run society. So the fury of the media at the moment, I mean, the media would argue, you know, we are very anti-Trump, we're very critical, he's the most powerful man in the world. This demonstrates how brave we are and how willing we are to criticize politicians. But in my view, it demonstrates the exact opposite, which is that they had been so intimately linked to the old political class that they are now basically fighting to delegitimize and denormalize the democratic choices made by the people of Britain and the people of America. And they're doing that through constantly waging a war of words on Brexit, day in, day out. And by saying that we shouldn't normalize Trump because he's an aberration. He's not a legitimate leader. He doesn't make sense. So that, I think, confirms how utterly wedded they had become to the old establishment. So I think, and this is why, of course, people in Britain and America and elsewhere no longer trust the media. You know, the media is always saying, why are people going online and looking for other sources of information and in the process sometimes being fed false information? Well, the answer to that question is very obvious. It's because the media has made itself untrustworthy through allowing itself to become so intimately bound up with the political establishment.
Yeah, well, it's interesting the way you put that. You know, a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of what's happened, the rise of Breitbart, for example, as a news network, I don't think that would have been possible 10, 20 years ago, simply because I think it would have been rejected. I think people would have found that the news they had was relatively balanced and that they didn't really feel they needed something that was so far opposite to what they were being told. Now, you know, there are examples daily of high-profile reporters for CNN, the New York Times, Washington Post, all these sort of top media organizations who are actively campaigning on behalf of politicians on their side, basically, and usually that's on the left side of things. So we've got a lot of that going on. I'm just interested to know, before the elections the reporting on Trump was largely negative. So the argument that they were fighting a most powerful man was a false argument then. I think it's still a bit of a false argument now. And there's nothing brave about preaching to a whole bunch of people you agree with about things you agree with. I mean, it's the Meryl Streep example. There was nothing brave about a liberal standing up in front of a room of liberals and saying liberal things. You know, I'm putting liberal in inverted commas there. How long do you think we are before they stop doubling down? Because it would appear to me that instead of stepping back and, as you say, looking at things in a rational, measured sort of way, trying to be objective and say things like, oh, look, Donald Trump issued an immigration ban. It actually isn't about Muslims. It's got to do with immigration. You know, it happens to include some Muslim countries. But instead of going wild, they just double down and they sort of just run with, you know, Muslim ban as for example, one thing. Is there any point at which you think the media industry sort of steps back, resets, and goes, all right, we've lost the plot here. Let's change.
You know, I was just having that precise conversation with someone yesterday here in London, and I'm not sure what the answer to whether that's going to happen anytime soon or not. My feeling is that things are so intense right now that it's just difficult to tell. But the argument I'm having with the media here is that I cannot remember a time like now where it was as hysterical as it is right now. But everything Trump does is flagged up as evidence of his insanity and his fascism and his craziness and his illiberalism and his contempt for the press. You know, I get into arguments with journalists all the time. They say things to me like, Trump is the worst president ever when it comes to press freedom. He despises the press. And I say to them, well, what about Woodrow Wilson, who in the 1910s signed in both the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, which expressly forbade media outlets from publishing scurrilous or defamatory or ridicule about the government.
So news,
the news, exactly, the most extraordinary intervention into press freedom. And then people say, oh, well, you know, well, Trump has just got a crazy temperament. He's not measured enough to be president. And then I say, well, what about Richard Nixon, who in the early 1970s went completely paranoid and was known to stalk the White House at 3 a.m. making policy about Cambodia. Literally at 3 a.m, he would decide what the next stage of the bombing of Cambodia should be. So what I mean is that what's lost is any sense whatsoever of historical perspective, any sense that actually there have been crazy American presidents before. Actually, there have been attacks on press freedom before. And a lot of them, you know, these people complaining about them now turned a blind eye to them in the recent past. There have been American presidents have done crazy things overseas before. People are forgetting all this stuff. It's there's a historical amnesia, which I think I find quite Orwellian. It's like everything in the past is shoved down the memory hole. And Trump, and all we have is Hitler in the 1930s and Trump in 2017. And in between, everything was okay. I mean, this is literally the narrative that some people would like us to accept. So it is really unhinged and deeply, deeply worrying. So I don't know whether the media is going to get a grip anytime soon. My feeling is that things will get worse for a while. But then and I've already started to spot this, there will be a handful of voices saying, what the hell is going on here? This makes literally no sense. And so the more that those voices come out, and the more we can do to cultivate them, the more chance we have of getting politics back onto a level field.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite story, they keep telling me that Donald Trump is extremely racist with no evidence whatsoever. But Jesse Owens won 3 gold medals in front of Hitler, and FDR refused to acknowledge that when Jesse Owens returned back from the Berlin Games. But FDR is seen as a hero of the left, despite imprisoning 100,000 Japanese American citizens and refusing to acknowledge Jesse Owens. I mean, all this has been done before, much worse, by their own heroes, and no one knows about it. It is quite amazing.
Exactly, it's amazing, and it's quite Stalinist actually. there's almost not necessarily a conscious, but there's a semi-conscious airbrushing of history. So the more that they say Trump is abnormal and an aberration and unacceptable, the more that they implicitly or explicitly normalize everything that came before him. That was all reasonable in comparison to Trump, who is the great unreasonable leader. So there's a real whitewashing of history. And you know, you don't even have to go back to Wilson or to FDR or to Nixon. You only have to go back to Obama. You know, people are now saying, oh, my God, Trump is going to bomb countries and cause global instability. And I have to almost stop myself from laughing because it's not even funny when you consider the kind of instability that was created by Obama and Clinton in various different ways and the actions that they took, the thoughtless actions that they took. In the British newspapers yesterday, they were full, as they have been for weeks now, of anti-Trump stuff. Trump is crazy. Trump is unstable. Trump is mad. And then around page 15 or 16 in some of these newspapers, there was a report about a new UN study which showed that last year, in 2016, the number of deaths, civilian deaths in Afghanistan rose quite dramatically. And it said in really small print, which no one noticed, that in one of those incidents involved an American strike on a home, on a family home, which killed 12 women and 20 children. And it's and so I was saying this to my friends and I was emailing people and I said, did you know this? Did you know that under Obama, 20 children were killed in one airstrike in Afghanistan last year? And they just don't know. They actually don't know what happened because there is this self that they kind of have this pro-Obama filter. So any bad news about Obama just doesn't get through to them. Whereas every bad thing about Trump flies straight in and is believed instantly. So there's a deeply uncritical climate at the moment. And I think the Trump hysteria is really setting media debate and political debate back by years and years.
Let's talk a bit about Obama, because for some reason he's seen as some global hero. Well, mostly. Well, first of all, I mean, he had legislation that he had a kill list of American citizens that he could kill without due process whatsoever. So he woke up in the morning, had his eggs, and there was a kill list, and he just ticks off who he wants to be droned on that particular day. And let us not forget, he bombed, by mistake or not, a hospital in the middle of Aleppo with
I think NGOs. That was in Pakistan.
Was it Pakistan?
Yeah.
My mistake. But, I mean, he bombed weddings in Yemen, you know, 150 dead, two or three of them. He bombed hospitals. It is absolutely ridiculous. 26,000 bombs over the course of his second term. Why does no one seem to care? But if you ban Muslims, say it is a Muslim ban, if you do ban them, that is far more egregious.
It's extraordinary. I mean, the only explanation for it is that people are in the grip of almost a hysteria about Trump. I mean, it's the only, and hysteria is an extremely strong word that should not be used lightly. But I can think of no other explanation for what you've just very accurately described, which is that Obama did numerous terrible, destructive things around the world. And yet when he's leaving office, people are crying and posting memes of him, you know, hugging Michelle and, you know, with his baseball cap on backwards and saying, we're going to miss you, Barack, and all this stuff, despite all the stuff that he did. Whereas Trump passes a temporary 3-month ban on people from 7 Muslim majority countries. By the way, I don't think the ban is necessary. I'm opposed to it.
Yeah, as are we.
Right, but it's not. I just think it was rash, and I think it was about gesture politics. It was about appearing to be strong, and it did cause immediate problems for a large number of people. So I don't think it's a good thing.
He's appealing to his base.
Exactly, and. But it is just not comparable to what some of the things Obama did. And yet Trump's executive order is held up as evidence that he is Hitler in the making, whereas Obama's bombing of hospitals or his arming of groups in Syria that went on to become Islamist groups that beheaded a 12-year-old child, or his administration's bombing in Libya, which destabilized vast swathes of northern Africa, causing hundreds of thousands of refugees to go from Libya into Tunisia, intensifying the conflict in Mali because lots of armed groups moved from Libya back to Mali, and even intensifying the conflict in Nigeria, where lots of Libyan weaponry leaking out of post-Gaddafi Libya made its way into Nigeria. So the whole of North Africa destabilized by Obama, Clinton, and Samantha Power. People just overlook that, or they don't care about it. It's extraordinary. Trump issues a statement or makes a speech, and everyone says, look, there's Adolf Hitler. So I think the only explanation is that they are in the grip of this. What I think is happening is that the political set, that kind of, you know, liberal elite, for want of a better phrase, I know that's not the most useful description, but that liberal elite feel very lost at the moment. They feel very disconnected. They feel very wounded because in Britain and America in particular, they've been rejected by ordinary people. They don't know what they're for. They don't know what they're doing. They are very confused, and they are looking for a simple moral narrative, something that will give them a bit of clarity. And what they've landed upon is Trump is evil. Everyone who opposes Trump is good. And as I wrote in a piece for The Spectator today, that's the morality of the nursery. It's this very juvenile moral code which they cling on to because they feel so unanchored at the moment. So I think there's a lot going on behind the Trump hysteria, but it's so important to call it out. And I've spent the past 3 weeks being accused of being pro-Trump and a fellow traveler of fascism,
yeah,
and an apologist for the new Hitler, simply because I've devoted a lot of my time to saying Trump is not Hitler. Please calm down. But I think that's the most important argument that progressives need to have right now. The response, in my view, the response to Trump is far worse than Trump himself.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned the Hitler stuff, and I agree with you on that. You also, I thought quite poignantly in one of your Facebook posts, mentioned that, the 6 million Jews who were killed in the Holocaust are not your playthings. And I fully agree with that. I think I also feel like this is just a giant crying wolf episode. So thus far, we've got, you know, 2-3 weeks of President Trump. He really has done very little. There's obviously headline grabbing executive orders in terms of, you know, TPP's gone, which is probably not a bad thing. If you buy the free trade argument, then I'm not a big fan of TPP anyway. But, you know, TPP's gone. The immigration order was probably the biggest sort of faux pas. Even if it was a good idea, you want to argue, it was very poorly executed. And you know, a couple of other things. He's not funding abortion overseas and all the rest of that. But there's very little the man has done. If you then take the media argument, and not just the media argument, general public as well, what we're being told by celebrities who seem to be the new commentators of our society for some reason. I don't know why people who can act or people who can do voices or whatever it is suddenly are the arbiters of moral, sort of the moral compass. The problem is we are losing our minds every time he literally tweets. And then he will do something bad. There is no doubt. You can find, you know, Ramon was talking about all the bombs Obama dropped. And the truth be told is the common argument to that while Obama was around in his first term was, but George Bush. You know, if you look at George Bush, the argument would be, but Bill Clinton. The truth is that America has a certain way of treating the world and a certain policy. And you can't really change the State Department overnight, although it does look like Trump is trying. But I just wonder how dangerous it is that we will never notice when he actually does do something bad, because we'll be fatigued by the time we get there.
Yeah, I think that's a real concern. You know, the hysteria that greets every tweet he writes or every statement he puts out or every fairly minor action he takes, which is, you know, most of them so far have been relatively minor in the scheme of things, historically speaking, every one of them is greeted as a sign of the new Hitler. So, you know, if he does something that Obama did and bombs the country and kills lots of people, you know, what are we going to call that? And how much further can you push the language? I find the Hitler analogy and the discussion of the Holocaust, I I find it really deeply repulsive, actually. I don't think it's funny at all, and I don't think it's acceptable at all. And my main problem with it is that it actually contributes to this idea, which is quite pronounced among the far right in particular, and also among extreme Islamists, which is that the Holocaust was not all that special, that we exaggerate the horror of the Holocaust and we treat it as being too unique, and we accord it too much historical gravity. That's always been the argument of far right anti-Semites
and Holocaust deniers.
And also Holocaust deniers, of course, and also Islamist groups in particular, which over the past 20 years or so have argued that, you know, things like Holocaust Memorial Day must also include Muslim genocides, because they have this kind of competitive desire to chip away the gravity and the uniqueness of the Holocaust in the experience of the Jews. And when you say that another Holocaust is around the corner, or Trump is the new Hitler, or as one of the placards in the London protest said, Trump sounds like Hitler, we all know how this ends. What you're really doing is saying that the Holocaust is a pretty routine experience, and that it wasn't an historically specific, unique act of barbarism, probably the greatest crime in history. It wasn't that.
And we haven't advanced as a society at all, that we would allow people to be loaded onto trains or planes and be sent to concentration camps to their death. That in almost, not 100, but 80 years or whatever it is now, we literally have moved not one iota forward as a society, which can't be true.
It can't be true. It's just utterly unfeasible and unreasonable and hysterical. I mean, it's genuinely hysterical. And what it does is it sends the signal that the Holocaust is not special. And I think the spin-off from that is they're actually fueling certain ugly prejudices that exist in Europe, in particular in relation to the Holocaust. They're playing with fire. And it's a very, very dangerous game, and because it does two things. Firstly, it obscures what was specific about history. It makes it harder to understand history. And also it obscures or mystifies what's going on today, and it makes it seem more terrible than it actually is. So it mystifies the past and it mystifies the present, and it really makes people incapable of understanding what's actually going on. So I think their exploitation of the Holocaust in response to things, you know, pretty mild things that Trump has done, is really, really irresponsible.
I mean, I don't think we can disagree with that.
Can't add to
at
that.
All. So, Brendan, so just to finish off, so the antidote to all this is obviously Spiked Online, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure
mm-hmm.
you would agree with me.
Definitely.
When you, what do people, if people do click through from this interview, what do you want them to see there at Spiked Online specifically?
I want them to see a publication which believes in freedom and reason, and a publication which sees itself as carrying on the arguments of the very early left, which is the idea that people should be freer and wealthier. And that's obviously easy to say, but what that means on those two fronts is that on the freedom front, you have to argue against all forms of censorship and all hate speech laws and all campus clampdowns on controversial speakers and all new forms of conformism which encourage self-censorship and so on and so forth. So it's a real continual battle to demand freedom of thought, freedom of speech, moral autonomy in everyday life, an end to smoking bans, an end to licensing laws on booze and everything else. So on the freedom front, we're continually arguing against censorship and social control in order to allow the human spirit to flourish more and allow people to take meaningful responsibility for their lives by being free and making choices. And then on the other front, in terms of making people wealthier, which is the other thing that the left used to want to do and which Spike still wishes we could do, you need to argue against things like not only the lack of ambition and the slothfulness of the modern Western economy and of institutions like the EU in particular, but also against the politics of environmentalism, against the idea that human progress has been a bad thing, against ideas like sustainable development in Africa, which too often means no development, against the idea that China and India having more stuff is going to pollute the world and it's utterly unacceptable. So what I think they will find on Spite is a website that believes that trusts ordinary people to run their own lives, which wants ordinary people to have richer, more fulfilling lives, but which recognizes that in order to get those things, you have to argue day in, day out against all the new modern PC supposedly liberal trends of censorship and environmentalism and the new authoritarianism and all those things. So I think they'll find a website that's positive about the potential of humanity, but is pretty ruthlessly critical of all the people who stand in the way of that.
Can I ask you to expand a little bit on the climate politics? And obviously that part about sustainable development in Africa, I think, is absolutely on the mark. What's your take on that?
My take is that the politics of I'm not a climate change denier as such. I recognize or I accept that there humanity has had some kind of impact on the climate, or you know, pollution is something that we should think about and think about fixing. But I think the politics of environmentalism has largely emerged as an argument against economic development and against economic growth and against progress. It's the modern means for arguing that we should know our place, that we should not venture too much further into nature, that we should not build too much, that we should not develop too much. It's a liberal sounding justification for a lack of development. And I think that's what environmentalism fundamentally represents. So I'm utterly opposed to the politics of environmentalism, not because I want to see us trash nature. I think the more measures we can take to offset the pollution we cause, the better. But I recognize that environmentalism is really about low horizons for humanity. It's really about keeping us in the stasis that we're currently in, rather than thinking about how we might grow and expand the human footprint so that more and more parts of humanity are included in it. And, you know, just to come back to what we were talking about at the start about the left in its origins, I always encourage people, including people on the right, to read the Communist Manifesto, which Marx and Engels wrote when they were very young, in their 20s. And people are always surprised because the first 10 pages or so are devoted to praising the new capitalist class and talking about how they have achieved wonders that outdo ancient Rome. And it talks about how they have civilized backward tribes. I mean, it's very un-PC. It talks about how they've instituted global trade, broken down national barriers. They produce more stuff. They transport it around the world. I mean, it goes on and on, praising and praising. That's the kind of thing that the left used to be interested in. How can we expand the human footprint? How can we have more production, more development, more growth, more wealth? And I think the left has given up on that, but it can't admit that it's given up on that, so it dresses it up in the language of saving the planet.
Sure.
Well, yeah, saving the planet, yes. I fully agree. Brendan, I do think you have disproved the fact that you're a Marxist. You sound a bit like a libertarian.
I don't know. I have to say, I think you're a right-wing conservative. Frankly,
oh, wow.
I think we could put you and Ben Shapiro in the same room and you'd get on like a house on fire.
No, but Brendan's not a moralist.
No, he's not a moralist. But
and also, I'm pro-choice, so we'd have a big argument. Me and Ben Shapiro would have a big argument on that.
It's his single blind spot, but he's pretty good at other stuff.
But I should say that the one thing I would always – I always say this to people and they get a bit confused, which is that in my mind there is not a contradiction between being a Marxist and a libertarian. And, you know, in fact, when I go to America, when I do talks in America, they understand that in America far more than people understand it in Europe. They recognize that, you know, in the original Marx or the early Marx or the very early left – there was a very strong libertarian streak. And so I do call myself a Marxist libertarian, partly to wind people up because I know it confuses and outrages them. But at the same time, I would insist until the day I die that there is not necessarily a contradiction between those two things. And in fact, they could complement each other. I just haven't entirely worked out how, but I'm sure I'll get there.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
we need to do our own research now on the Communist Manifesto.
You must read it.
I've read some parts. They're very difficult people to read, I must be honest. But yes,
Marx is a bit tedious.
It's very 19th century, so once you get around that, you'll be all right.
Fair enough. Brendan, really, thank you. A great honor to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
And everyone listening, please follow him on Facebook. The rants are superb. That's amazing.
Yeah, you are definitely one of my favorite commentators on Facebook. Obviously, can find your content and all of the Spiked Online content at spiked-online.com. Highly, highly recommend it. I think Ramon, he's your first site visitor. So,
well, yes, when I first started. Brendan, sorry, one last thing before you go. Why on earth are you not on Twitter?
I just can't handle Twitter. And also, the main reason is I read a column about this about 5 years ago. I have a very short temper, and I often say things and email things that I probably shouldn't. And so the thought of me having an app on my phone that would allow me to say something to the whole world with a click of my thumb is too terrifying to contemplate, because I know I would say stuff that I would regret instantly. So basically, I trust humanity, but I don't trust myself. So I have to kind of hold back from Twitter. I can't handle that.
You're missing out on a lot of fun. To wind up people with three words on a screen, it gives me, yes.
Look, anonymous accounts.
It gives me a fizz in my
An anonymous account. Come on, you can join the fun.
I'll think about it.
Great. Thanks so much. Thank you so much for joining us. And we hope to chat to you again once Brexit has gone through and your country is once again free to govern itself.
Thanks very much, guys.
Cheers, eh?
Thank you.
Well, another great chat with a really great, interesting guest.
Another international guest. We are going global.
Well, that's all from the Renegade Report this time round. You can like us on Facebook. That's our page, the Renegade Report, and on Twitter at Renegade_Report. You can find Ramon on Twitter at Roman Kabanek and myself at Jonathan_Witt. We will catch you next time. Rate us on iTunes, tell your friends about us, and thanks so much for listening. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.